First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
A judge rules against mask mandate bans in Florida schools. So what's next? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a safe and happy weekend. We begin the work week with a closer look at where the state's mask wars go from here as Nassau County starts masking up all students and staff today in schools. Not St. John's, though. Get on the line. It's 549-2937. Then later, the sweet success of Peter and Allison Berenger of Sweet Pete's Candy. But first this hour, mask requirements start today in Nassau County schools for all students and staff. They are the latest Florida district to defy the governor on this safety measure for kids. A full mask mandate goes into effect in Duval County right after Labor Day. Now on Friday, a Leon County judge sided with a group of parents in a high-profile lawsuit challenging the governor's executive order that sought to bar school districts from requiring face coverings for students. This comes as the state continues to battle the virus. The pandemic is worse now in Florida than it has ever been before, with more people getting sick, getting hospitalized, and dying. 94% of the adult ICU beds in this state are now occupied, more than half of them with COVID-19 patients. And Florida has the most cases of kids positive for the virus and sick with COVID now in the nation. Charles Gallagher of Gallagher & Associates firm in St. Petersburg is one of the attorneys representing parents in this battle over mask mandates in schools. He did see a victory in court Friday. He's also just retained retired Florida Supreme Court Chief Justice Wells to join him in the upcoming appeal. So where does this all go from here? Well, Charles Gallagher joins us once again, and it's good to have you back on the show, Charles. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. As I mentioned, Charles, in Duval, there's going to be a mandate with a medical opt-out starting September 7th. Nassau County in our listening area starts a mask mandate today. St. John's County has a staff-only mandate. You just retained the retired Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court to your legal team. So where does this legal battle go from here?
Certainly. So from about the time of the court's ruling on Friday until even right now, as we said, we have been preparing the written order to memorialize the court's oral rulings. Once we get that in final form, we will have counsel for the state to take a peek at that, review that, and weigh in on whether they believe that's accurate with regard to the comments and the rulings made by the court. Thereafter, we would then forward that order to the court for review and execution.
Now,
so it's a lengthy process.
The state has vowed to appeal. They believe that the decision will be reversed on appeal. What say you?
So that's the kind of the first thing I would approach is that the idea of appealing a trial court matter is not because someone doesn't like the outcome. There would need to be some underlying legal error that supports the appeal. So folks need to understand the fact that just because you don't like how it resolved at trial does not mean you can appeal just because you want to appeal. So they would need to have perfected some type of legal error that occurred by the court to support an appeal in this case. And we don't think that's present.
Okay, well, what should parents take from this? As I mentioned, it's now, I believe, 11 districts with the addition of Nassau County that are mandating masks for students. So more than half of the students in Florida will be under a mask mandate in spite of the governor's order banning the same. He had threatened school boards and education officials with dismissal or the docking of their pay if they went against him on this. They're going against him anyway. Does the judge's ruling Friday mean that those threats have no legal weight? Can he still follow through with those threats?
Well, once the order is memorialized in a written form and executed, that becomes more of a certainty. I think that from the court's lengthy oral ruling on Friday, it's abundantly clear that those school boards have the right to enact whatever policies they see fit for their respective counties. If they believe they need a mask mandate, they would be permitted to enter those kinds of rules and guidelines without fear of any kind of financial fines or any kind of penalties.
There's urgency to this, given that Florida now leads the nation, Charles, with the highest number of kids positive for COVID. 48,000 new cases in the last 7 days. The Delta variant of the virus is affecting children more than what we saw with the first waves of this. We are seeing more kids coming into pediatric ICUs with COVID-19. The nation's children's hospitals have banded together, calling on everyone to get vaccinated, to mask up, to social distance and hand wash. This is an open letter that includes local hospitals like Wolfson Children's Hospital in Jacksonville. And so for parents, for pediatricians, there is real urgency to this court fight.
Absolutely. This is a day-in, day-out issue. The urgency could not be any more important. Kids are going to school right now as we speak. Classes are being closed down. Schools are being closed down. And the numbers are just, quite frankly, scary with regard to children's positivity and children contracting COVID in a place where we can't have any children getting it. It's that important.
You know, we spoke the other day with an anonymous employee in the St. Johns County schools. He's also a parent who has a child in the school district there. And keep in mind, there is now a mask mandate in St. Johns County schools for staff only, not for students. We spoke with him before this ruling came down, Charles, from Judge Cooper. But I want us to take a listen to this quickly as this man shares his thoughts as both an educator and a parent. Let's listen. Good to speak with you. So tell me about what's going on in your household right now under quarantine.
Well, my son and I are quarantined. He went to school last week and unfortunately did come home with the virus. And he and I tested positive. So we are kind of holed up in part of our house. So my wife and daughter are secluded in the other part of the home. Away from us, and it's been hard. He had some mild symptoms early on, and I kind of am taking a little bit more of the brunt of it. I did get vaccinated, so I think that's a saving grace on my end,
mm-hmm.
Because I've had coworkers and friends hospitalized over this, and I'm thankful that I'm you know, writing up fairly well.
Is your son too young to be vaccinated?
Yes, he is.
So what are your thoughts then about the policy in St. Johns County? They're encouraging mask wearing, but unlike Duval County, they won't be mandating it, at least not right now for students, although they have started to do it for staff.
I find it unfortunate. I find that the policy for staff is in a step in the right direction. It's a baby step. You know, but I see it in our school. There's seldom mask wearing, and it's a concern. I don't see this ending very positively, unfortunately.
How would you say the other employees in the St. Johns County schools feel when you talk to some of your colleagues about all this?
It's a mixed bag. Everybody I've talked to, they kind of have their own story. You know, I think back to last summer when you heard somebody had COVID who knew someone who had COVID. But now I think we're all feeling it. You know, we've got coworkers within our district that have passed away. We have spouses that have passed away. You know, brothers, sisters. It's hard, and that's hitting home a lot more. You know, there's still some mixed feelings regarding masks. I see that a lot. I hear it a lot. You know, but it's unfortunate that it's kind of become a political battle. Over something that is that's health related.
You feel that people, including the students, should all be masked?
I do, yes.
And okay, so Charles Gallagher, there you have it. That is an employee in the St. Johns County Schools who has a son in the school system. They're both quarantined, positive for the virus. and worried because they are not going into their workplace or educational environment with a mask mandate for students.
It's chilling when you think about the fact that we already have a prevalence of breakthrough infections with folks that have been vaccinated. And then looking to the populations of under 12 kids in schools that can't be vaccinated, they are potentially the most vulnerable class of people in this context right now. And just very, very, very chilling to hear the fact that his kids have to go to school at a place where only staff would mask and there would not be masking from students. Our experts were very clear on the fact that kids can transfer COVID as adults do. So putting him into that context is a very scary thing, I think, and I would agree he would have cause for concern.
549-2937, give us a call. Here's a tweet from Julie. What about municipalities? Will cities that were hesitant, will they now be emboldened by the school district's success in court enough to issue mask mandates themselves? Now, keep in mind, Charles, the governor has made it illegal for mayors and municipal leaders to bring back mandates of any kind to slow the spread of this virus. Could this situation with the school ruling set any kind of legal precedent to give them cover to buck the governor as well?
I think that it would probably be best to have a independent legal challenge to that executive order. But what I'm hearing from folks out of state is that they are aghast that we don't have those types of rules and guidelines. There are rules and guidelines outside of Florida that you must mask when entering public facilities, public buildings, and you must mask when you're among other individuals in close quarters outdoors. So, you know, I think we are an outlier in terms of states that have requirements for masking generally. But I do think that we do now have a harbinger of what a court could do and has done on the issue of masking, more likely applied to cities and counties and other municipalities within the state of Florida.
Can you tell us, too, a little bit about the impact you expect from retired Florida Supreme Court Chief Justice Charles Wells joining your legal team?
In short, we think it's just a game changer in terms of the appellate defense of the appeal. To have someone who can and render advice and give context and give us assistance where they have been sitting there as the chief judge of the Florida Supreme Court is simply invaluable. To be able to weigh in on strategic decisions and the actual defense of the appeal, we feel just abundantly grateful that he is saw fit to join the team, and his assistance will be, again, just profoundly impactful.
We're speaking with Attorney Charles Gallagher, representing parents who sued over the governor's ban on mask mandates in schools. They won the first round in court. What are your questions? 549-2937. Here's a tweet from Susan. Can anyone sue the governor over preventing counties from having mask mandates? You mentioned there does need to be a separate legal action brought there. Are you hearing any rumblings of that?
We hear rumblings of many future to be filed actions. I've not heard anyone speak to this, specifically that executive order. But to answer the caller's question, yes, any citizen who believes they are aggrieved by that executive order could potentially file a lawsuit to challenge that executive order that precludes various cities and counties from having their own mandates. You could have cities or counties or other municipalities file an action to challenge that very executive order as well. So, you could have a coalition of folks that would bring a suit on those issues to invalidate the order that says that cities and counties can't enact mask mandates and have mandatory masking in those spaces.
You know, in St. John's County, parents who've been lobbying that school district to require a mandate accuse the school board members and the superintendent in St. John's of hiding behind the governor's emergency order. Now that it has been struck down by a judge, does that give parents in districts where masks are not mandated any more legal leverage to go in and lobby?
I think so. And what you have is you have a well-thought-out, articulate chronology of the facts and the issues in that order, and then it'll be reduced to a written order very soon that speaks to why it was not permissible and why it was why there was an ability to go ahead and declare it to be unconstitutional. So in that context, where you, for no good reason, for those charmed words of arbitrary and capricious, enact some underlying executive order, government action, those will be challenged and challenged successfully where they can't support a rational basis behind it to support that. And I think you may have additional litigation forthcoming down the pipeline on those issues.
And what about the threats that continue to come from the Department of Education and Commissioner Richard Corcoran saying that districts are going to face consequences for defying the governor on this mask policy?
And I think that the court, in our case, you know, squarely rejected that entitlement, squarely rejected that power. So, you know, they were trying to utilize a brief window upon the written order being entered and the oral ruling being rendered. I understand that they had sent those compliance letters even the afternoon of Friday in this case. But the doubling down over and over and over again, I don't believe is supported by this forthcoming order. I don't think that you're going to have any kind of ability for the Department of Education or the its enforcement mechanisms to be successful on those threats.
Interesting. You know, Governor DeSantis is speaking in Jacksonville at the Department of Health alongside Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry at 9:30 this morning. Not sure if he'll touch on this matter. Have you spoken with anyone from the governor's office in throughout this whole legal fight that is not over yet?
We have not. It has been purely counsel for the governor and counsel for the various defendants, the co-defendants. We've had no direct contact with him.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to follow it. It's fascinating, and it is not over yet. As we talk with attorney Charles Gallagher of Gallagher & Associates firm in St. Petersburg, representing parents across the state who successfully sued over the governor's ban on mask mandates for students in Florida school districts. 11 districts are now mandating masks, including Duval and Nassau counties. All students and staff must be masked unless you have a note from a doctor. Charles Gallagher, I'm sure we'll touch base with you again soon, and thank you so much for being with us.
I look forward to it. All the best. Thank you.
Much more still ahead later in the hour, how the Jags scored their first preseason win. That's with our own Josh Torres, but up next.
Neither one of us could imagine doing something different. I know for me, I mean, candy is everything. I love it. And so to be able to pull whatever resources you have and start over. And so that's what we did and enabled us to do a lot of different things creatively.
First Coast Success takes a taste of Sweet Pete's path to big candy sales. That's coming up.
How can the local news media serve you better? Hi, this is WJCT Editorial Director Jessica Palumbo. And we want to hear what topics interest you, when you'd like to read about them, and how you might want to lend your voice to the stories that your neighbors read. Help us shape the newsletter that we're creating for you. Take our quick survey now at wjct.org/survey. And thanks.
Northeast Florida artists are making noise that's reverberating across the country, and the Jacksonville Music Experience is your ticket to the local scene. Music reviews, curated playlists, music history, concert recommendations, and profiles of local artists, all put together by our team of local contributors. The Jacksonville Music Experience plays it local and plays it loud. Visit jacksmusic.org to read and hear more.
Today's segment of First Coast Success is brought to you by Iberia Bank.
Welcome back. Well, for one Jacksonville couple, dreaming up sweet treats is all in the family. In today's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Jack's Daily Record speaks with Peter and Allison Berenger of Sweet Pete's Candy and their new venture, Fizzy's and Fair Restaurant.
Peter and Allison Berenger are known for their Sweet Pete's Candy, a decade-old company that has anchored the historic downtown Seminole building for about 7 years. Children and other visitors watch their crew make candy, take photos with the seasonal decorations, and of course, indulge in the candy and desserts and the nostalgic toys. The Berengers recently started a new venture there, the Fizzy's and Fair Restaurant. Peter and Allison Berenger, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you for having us.
Well, Peter, you are the Peter in Peterbrook, a candy company started by your mother, Phyllis Geiger, almost 40 years ago, I believe. You've been in the industry a long time. Why did you two open your own business, and what's your strategy?
Well, I grew up in the chocolate business and loved it. We were able to do something we loved and put our heart into. We expanded the business over the years, and then about a little over 10 years ago, with a financial crisis, sort of led us to have to bring on partners, and it just wasn't a good fit for us. And so we ended up leaving Peterbrook and kind of in a situation where we, you know, like a lot of people, a lot of retailers were suffering at the time. And so we were able to kind of scrape together what we had and start a new concept. I think neither one of us could imagine doing something different. I know for me, I mean, candy is everything. I love it. And so to be able to just, you know, pull whatever resources you have and start over. And so that's what we did, and it enabled us to do a lot of different things creatively. So it led us on a different path, and I think kind of our careers are better than ever as a result.
What were those creative things? What is your strategy?
Our strategy has kind of evolved over the years. In the beginning, we really went with an all-natural route because we felt like we needed to do something different since there was already quite a bit of chocolate in town. And we stuck with that for a while, and we have always stuck with a gluten-free kitchen and offering vegan options. So that's still a segment of what we do, but it's no longer the heart of it. Quickly, when we were in Pearl Street, we realized we needed to get into more experiential retail because the area was, when we were the only things there, it was kind of a ghost town. So we started doing the candy cane classes, and then that developed into field trips and parties. So now that's still a large part of our business. And then over the last few years, the website has grown significantly. And then really since COVID, our wholesale has taken off. So now we kind of see our strategy as those four segments, typical retail, now the restaurant, so five segments. The restaurant, typical retail, the experiences, and then wholesale and the website. And our goal is to be able to just churn as much chocolate out of that location without having to bring on any more overhead to be able to fill everything.
I have to ask, what's your best seller and what's your favorite?
Well, our best seller is the sea salt caramel. That was something that we developed early on, and it's sort of put us on the map. It created a lot of repeat business. As far as my favorite, it always changes. That's why it's good to have a lot of variety, because I eat a lot of candy, and I get sick of one thing, and I can move on to something else. But typically, I like anything with chocolate and caramel and pecans. That's a good combination.
I think a lot of people might agree with you on that. Well, you opened first in Springfield, as you were saying, and then you attracted a famous investor. And tell us about your experience with Marcus Lemonis. He's host of the Profit Reality TV series, and he remains an investor.
It's been kind of crazy. TV is, you know, it just happened very fast. We randomly applied one night, and then having some wine, applied, right. And then we got a call like 3 days later, and a month later we were told we were going to be on the show. So in those early years, it was a lot of growth really fast, and he's an intense personality, so it was fun, but it was a little chaotic. But now it's kind of just, we're all settled into the partnership, and it's pretty easy.
And I've seen you on subsequent shows. You're brought in as advisors or as guides. Is that fun?
It is. It's fun to be on the other side of it, where you're not the one being picked apart sometimes. It's a very surreal experience, reality TV is.
What made it surreal?
Just, it's hard to explain, but when you have the cameras on you and you have, it's just a very intense experience. And at the same time, you sort of go throughout the process and you forget the cameras are there. And I guess it's just a very strange experience, and you sort of look back on it and you see yourself on film after the fact, and it just it's just very strange. It's hard to explain unless you've really had that kind of, I guess, everybody having the feeling that everybody in the world is watching you is really intense too.
And it brought a lot of exposure to the business.
Oh, it helped us grow tremendously.
I would say it's funny because once that episode aired, for us, anybody in like chocolate or candy, Christmases, they're all very busy, and you kind of know, like, okay, we're only going to be working this crazy for 3 weeks or a week at Valentine's. And when that show aired, it was a blessing, but it was like, it was so intense that it never ended, and you didn't know, you know, every day you'd think, okay, we're gonna get the orders out, and then you'd come in and it would be thousands again.
Well, they would rerun the show, and so you would think you clear out the queue and everything's done, and then they'd air sometimes like 2 in the morning or something, and then boom, you have all this, it's all over again, which I'm not complaining. It was great, but it was an experience.
Now, where do you make the candy? I know you have a production facility at the Seminole Building.
That's where we make just about everything. And it's a relatively small kitchen, but a lot bigger than what we had before. But we primarily focus on sea salt caramel, you know, twist wrap products, chocolate bars, and hard candy. Support more most of our core products. So we try to keep a simple manufacturing scheme that, you know, that's efficient. Try not to do things that are counter to that. So once you, if you have a few good things, you can produce a lot of. It's works out pretty well.
Well, Peter and Allison Beringer, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thanks for having us.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT Public Media is your ticket to the local scene. Music reviews, curated playlists, music history, concert recommendations, profiles of local artists, and more. Turn your ear on the beautiful noise emerging from Northeast Florida and learn more about the local artist whose music is reverberating across the country. Visit jacksmusic.org to play it local and play it loud.
Let's talk sports. The Jaguars chalked up their first preseason win yesterday with Trevor Lawrence at the helm as the official QB1. Our director Josh Torres has some thoughts about the Jags' performance on the field and the fate of Gardner Minshew, too. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Melissa. Hello, everybody.
All right. So no surprise, Trevor Lawrence is starting. And let's talk about how he did.
Yeah. Finally, last week, Urban Meyer announced that number one overall pick, Trevor Lawrence, will be the starter week one against the Houston Texans. This was something I think a lot of people, one, saw coming because he's performed fantastic during the training camp, during preseason games. He's kind of looked a little shaky, but at the same time, they're missing four of their five starting offensive linemen. So it's not exactly easy when, you know, you're trying to not get hit. But they they finally did announce him as the starter, and I think it's going to do really great for him because now he can practice with the starting offense. He can really get all the reps he needs in the 2 weeks that are leading up to the first game. And I think we all need to take a moment to put our thoughts and prayers to senior producer Heather Schatz as yes. Her favorite player, Gardner Minshew, has unfortunately been traded to the Philadelphia Eagles. This was something he came in trying to compete against Trevor Lawrence for the starting QB job. It was always going to be a very tough task. Unfortunately, he's just looked really shaky during the preseason and during training camp. And the Jags had always been kind of putting feelers out to other teams to see if anybody wanted to pick him up. And finally, on Saturday, the Eagles did. Funny enough, I was the first person to tell Heather.
Oh, really?
As soon as I started seeing the reports about it, I shot her a text and unfortunately, I think ruined her Saturday.
Heather, do you want to get on the mic and share your thoughts of mourning at the loss of your sweet Minshew to Philly, the land of cheesesteaks, the land of the Liberty Bell, the land of Rocky? She doesn't want to talk. She's too overcome with grief, let's just say.
Yes, unfortunately. But the Jags did get a 2022 conditional sixth-round pick for him. The condition is that if he does play in, and this is kind of weird, at least in my opinion, if he plays in 50% of the offensive plays in three games this year, that sixth-round pick, becomes a fifth-round pick. So there are the conditions set on that. And then on top of that, Trevor Lawrence is also going to be without one of what was going to be considered one of his biggest offensive weapons as the 25th pick, Travis Etienne, unfortunately will be out for the year. He got a fracture, I believe it was, on his foot. And because they had to put him on the injured reserve list before the season started, before he was officially announced on the 53-man roster, it completely ends his season. So he will be gone for the year. And this is a guy that they were really hoping they'd be able to use his speed on the offensive side of the ball, really get him insert in, you know, certain packages that will really get him downfield and get him open. So he will be going into week one without a big weapon, but he still had one more preseason game that he had to go through. And as the Jags played the Dallas Cowboys yesterday, they were coming off of a 23-21 loss to the Saints last week. And this week, man, the offense finally came together. Trevor had easily his best game of the preseason. He went 11-for-12 for 139 yards and threw his first two touchdown passes of this preseason and his first two in a Jags uniform. And man, he looked absolutely in command.
That's exciting.
He had perfect placement. Looked like him and the receivers were finally just clicking. There was a very beautiful play with Laviska Shenault where Trevor immediately took the snap and recognized that it was man-to-man coverage and just threw the ball exactly where Shenault was. He quickly grabbed the ball, threw it, knew where he was. Laviska just caught it, touchdown. He looked great. The entire offense looked fantastic.
And that's what we want to see heading into a new season with all this talent, you know, all this excitement around the team for the first time really in a long time.
Yep, for the first time in a very long time. There is a lot of hype around the offense, and Jags fans are very excited. The team went on to win 35-14, ending their preseason 1-2. And now is today and tomorrow, Urban Meyer and his staff are going to be very, very busy as they are going to be trimming the roster down to the final 53-man opening day roster. The deadline's tomorrow at 4 p.m. as we approach the first game of the regular season on September 12th when the Jags are going to head to Houston to take on the Texans.
Oh, my gosh. Here we go. Okay, now, Josh, you are a big Formula One guy, as we all know.
Yes.
So I know it's not really your thing to talk about NASCAR, but we got to talk about it.
Hey, I am a huge Formula One fan, but I also respect all types of racing.
That's right.
On Saturday night, it was the Coke Zero Sugar 400 race at Daytona. Usually, you know, at the beginning of the year, they have the Daytona 500, but just before their playoffs begin, they always come back to Daytona for their final race. And this race, man, the last 30 minutes were crazy. There was the famous, as they would say, the big one, the big crash at the end. Ryan Blaney won his second race in two weekends. He won last weekend in Michigan. He won this weekend in Daytona, and he got it after a big wreck was caused. The caution came out with about three laps to go, so NASCAR rules dictate they go into overtime, and during the overtime, ran in the final lap, there was another big wreck. Ryan Blaney snuck through, claimed first place as they go into the playoffs, and on top of that, Mr. Bubba Wallace, the NASCAR's only current full-time African-American driver, snuck through the wreck, finished third, and then due to a disqualification for the driver who finished in second, was promoted to second place.
Nice.
And I wanted to mention that too, because one of his heroes, and this is a fantastic story that I didn't even know about, and I found out about this weekend, that has some ties to Jacksonville. NASCAR formally gave a trophy to Wendell Scott. For those of you who don't know who Wendell Scott is, he was the first African-American to receive a NASCAR license to race back in the 60s. And in 1963, and to this date, he is the only African-American to ever win a race in NASCAR's top series. At the time, it was called the Grand National Series.
Uh-huh.
In December of 1963, he won a race right here in Jacksonville, Florida. It was the Jacksonville 200 over at Speedway, the old dirt oval in Speedway Park. He passed Richard Petty with 25 laps to go and won the race. But after the race, Buck Baker was named the winner. You know, I won't really go into the reasons as to why he was named a winner.
Is this just due to the racism of the time?
That is the speculation. And it wasn't until 2 hours after the race that officials realized that not only did Wendell win the race, he had won by over two laps.
Wow.
So, but NASCAR didn't even officially really acknowledge him as the winner until 2 years after the race. and his family didn't even receive any kind of acknowledgement such as the trophy until 2010 when he finally received the trophy for winning the race. Unfortunately, Wendell Scott had already passed away due to spinal cancer back in the 90s.
Mm.
But then this weekend, NASCAR actually held a ceremony to really, you know, celebrate his win. Yesterday would have been his 100th birthday. So on Saturday, they decided to give him a nice celebration to commemorate his win back in 1963.
And his spirit cheering Bubba Wallace on.
Yes.
Okay. That's a great story, Josh. All right. Let's talk college football, beginning with our HBCU. EWU taking to the field.
Yes. EWU started this weekend their first game in NCAA Division II football, and they had a beautiful win on their brand new field, Nathaniel Glover Community Field and Stadium. They won against Florida Memorial University 24-20 off of a last second QB run. Uh-huh. I think with just a few, almost no time left on the clock, it was marked their first win as an NCAA Division II team and their first win for their new head coach. So great. Great effort by Edward Waters University and a great win by them.
Nice. Love to see that. So let's talk quickly about Miami, Florida, Florida State, and Georgia. College football fans, this is your time to shine.
This is the time of year that all football fans crave when we have college football and we have NFL football. This weekend, we're going to see Miami travel up to Atlanta to play the number one ranked at Alabama Crimson Tide. It's going to be a real tough game, but, you know, Miami's starting quarterback's coming back for, I believe, his senior year, so it's going to be a great matchup. We got Georgia, who's going to be playing Clemson in North Carolina at the Bank of America Stadium. Florida's going to have a little bit of a tune-up game against FAU, and then Florida State is going to be opening up against Notre Dame. That's going to be a real tough matchup for them. It's going to be taking place at Doak Campbell, and we're going to probably be expecting a lot of memorial for the late, great Bobby Bowden. It's going to be the first game at Doak since he passed away, so expect a lot of memorial services for him and a lot of just emotion running high during that game.
Sure. And it's so great to have you on the show now every Monday as we head into the fall, because there's so much sports to talk about.
Oh, yes, there was. I was texting senior producer Heather Schatz all weekend and telling her I'm going to have to start cutting stuff because there's so much I could be talking about right now.
That's right. That's right. He's our own Josh Torres. And not only does he drive this bus every morning, he's also now our resident sports analyst. Thanks, Josh.
Thanks, Melissa.
And in a moment, how local DJs keep the music spinning here in the 904, even in a time of pandemic.
In the pandemic, it's been interesting because we can almost see the waves as they come.
That's coming up next. Don't go away.
The book, An Englishman in the Seminole War, a memoir based upon the letters of John Bemrose, is available to the public for the first time. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Randall Agostini, editor and great-great-grandson of John Bemrose. The Gerald Schaffner Lecture Series and People of the Everglades on Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Scott Tong. Reporter Craig Whitlock of the Washington Post has uncovered a trove of government documents and audio files telling an inside story of the Afghanistan war.
It was remarkable the degree to which they were struggling to figure out who the enemy was. The shorthand for them was the bad guys.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJTT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Sandra Oh, who stars in the new Netflix comedy series, The Chair. She plays the first person of color and the first woman to chair the English department at a prestigious college. Oh also starred in the popular thriller series Killing Eve and in ABC's long-running medical series Grey's Anatomy. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The Supreme Court has struck down a freeze on evictions. That decision could leave millions of renters and homeowners in the cold. And as you told us, signing up for rental assistance is a trial all its own.
It was an absolute nightmare.
Are we headed for an eviction crisis? We'll get into it next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, as the pandemic drags on and on, people who want to get out and enjoy live music are turning to local DJs who can spin up some fun in an outside venue, most commonly. Duval DJ Brooks Colleton is one of these local pros who's in demand. We spoke with him about what it's like to DJ parties in a time of pandemic and also his thoughts on the fallout from this city's recent Orange Crush Festival. Take a listen. Hey, Brooks, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
So there's a lot to get into when it comes to guys like you who DJ events and venues around town. A couple of things I want to ask you about, beginning with what it's been like in this pandemic for you.
In the pandemic, it's been interesting because we can almost see the waves as they come. So, for example, when businesses first opened again in summer of 2020, that was the first wave of people going back outside. So there was hesitancy between, I guess, the main population, the vaccine wasn't out yet, and we would just see groups of people willing to just come outside. So that was that faction. Then we saw the faction of the people when the first vaccines came out. So that was the second wave. And now we're seeing the third faction of like tourists and people coming out. So it's just interesting to see the waves of crowds and how they've just been responding.
And are you DJing indoors and outdoor venues? What's it like for you?
Yes, ma'am. Well, indoors, I'm pretty masked up because I have older family. So I try to limit as many contacts as I can. But outdoors is a lot easier. But it's just, it's always a thing. Like I was in some of the indoor events, it gets really tight. But I mean, it's the nature of the job. It's kind of the career I chose.
Do you ever worry?
I mean, I did in the beginning. Then I got vaccinated. I still stay masked up because, like I say, the vaccine is imperfect. But, I mean, anything can happen the moment you step outside of the house. So all
sure.
You can do is do your best.
Sure. Let me ask you about the Orange Crush Festival, which happened several months ago in Jacksonville. And that drew a lot of criticism from people who felt that the response of some business owners to a crush of people coming to party in Jacksonville, they felt Some reacted in a fearful and even racist way, shutting their doors for the weekend, not allowing kids in. From your perspective, what was that like in Jacksonville?
It was difficult for a number of reasons. It was difficult because Orange Crush had never been here before. So for them to critique something based off having no previous knowledge or history, I felt like was unfair. And for the businesses, I felt like that was also for nothing short of a lie for some scenarios, because the week before, they had a festival at the beach with 10,000 people. I want to say it was called Spring in the Blues or the Blues Festival.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty contradictory to a lot of people saying, well, we're not staffed enough. And I saw some PC answers, but the reason it bothered me as much as it did, because I remember having a conversation with my sister, and she was excited. She was like, oh, yeah, we're going to go to the car show and things of that nature. And I was like, I don't really get excited. Like, people are drunk before I even set up. So that's a whole other experience altogether. But it bothered me because you basically shut your doors to how would you have been able to differentiate a patron and a visitor? Somebody who lived here their whole life versus somebody who was just visiting. So you basically just said, we don't want anything to do with it. We don't want anything to do with your money. Contrasting to the point of when COVID was at its highest rate, you didn't close your doors. Nobody closed their doors. I know because I was working in some of these buildings where they were trying to close.
So where can people see you now? How can they follow you?
Now I'm pretty much on King Street a lot of times. So I'll do like the Loft on Fridays. I do a little hole in the wall Mickey's on Saturdays, and we do Sunday Fundays at Garage. I try to be in places that are open. Like I like dancing. I grew up in Jacksonville. I've been raised here my whole life. Most of the friends I met is from when I would just go out to bars and dance. So that's generally the type of environments I try to maintain and keep.
And you're on social media, too. People can follow you on Instagram.
Yes, ma'am. DJ Brooks on social media.
DJ Brooks Colleton, good to talk to you. Thanks so much. Keep the music going.
Yes, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Why do people keep calling me ma'am? Please stop that. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks to Heather Schatz, senior producer. She's old enough to be ma'amed now, too. Sorry, Heather. Director Josh Torres and associate producer Catherine Hobbs. Not quite at ma'am status just yet. Jessica Palumbo is our editorial director, and digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. Keep the emails coming, meanwhile, and check out our podcast up later today. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow, everyone. Get vaccinated and mask up.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.